Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, November 30th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and also available via podcast. More about that during the second half of the show. I'm your host for the hour, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with author Sean Wong. But first up, novelist Teddy Wayne. Teddy is the author of the novels The Love Song of Johnny Valentine and Capitoil. He's a columnist for the New York Times and a regular contributor to The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, and McSweeney's. He has taught at Columbia University and Washington University in St. Louis. His new novel is Loner. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And I'm so pleased to welcome him to the show. Hi there, Teddy. Teddy?
Yes.
Let's begin by having you introduce your book to us. Would you tell us about the story?
Sure. Loner is about, narrated by and about David Faderman, who's an 18-year-old boy from New Jersey who is beginning his freshman year at Harvard. And David has had a socially barren high school existence, adolescence, and is determined to reinvent himself at Harvard, where he thinks he'll find his tribe. Immediately, though, he realizes he's still low on the totem pole and becomes obsessed and infatuated with a sophisticated Manhattanite in his dorm, a girl named Veronica. And the book tracks the course of his increasing obsession over the course of the first semester.
David's voice is unique. So he's a high-achieving Harvard student, and he has sort of a self-importance that is projected. I mean, he uses words that are polysyllabic, and he also likes to manipulate words. Can you talk about developing the voice for David?
So, yeah, there are two factors that you point out. One is this kind of highfalutin, florid voice that feels like the kind of voice a Harvard freshman who's eager to prove his intelligence at every turn would cultivate. And it's, you know, the product of his background, a kind of kid who studies SAT words in his spare time. He separately has this compulsive tick almost of reversing words. So when he sees a word like novel, he would think of it as Levon, or David is Divad. And so the readers have different responses to what this is, but to me it feels like his need to control the world through language in some form, perhaps seeing it backwards. And this once, as a kid, became a little bit of a party trick for a few days, so a way for him to actually speak and be comfortable speaking to others, essentially, but only through this reversed, strange trick he has.
Yeah, I did see it as a control thing. I mean, I have a background in linguistics, and one of the things that we study is that it's unnatural in human language to reverse things, even though it's a logical possibility. And I actually heard some girls on the train once doing just what David does, you know, flipping these words around. And so I was curious for you how you found that idea, like what...
Well, at the risk of sounding like I'm David, and I'm certainly not, when I was 12 or so, when just the age he developed this trick, I found myself able to do it too, and sort of got into it. And it was sort of kind of fun to me. I've always been someone who likes logic and likes playing around with things and seeing how objects or ideas work in different ways. So I developed this skill, and it truly is, if you practice it, not that hard to do. You just do what David says, which is visualize the word syllable by syllable and just sort of read it backwards on the screen of your mind. So it's kind of fun. I am very rusty and don't do it anymore. But for a little time, it was a sort of party trick, a kind of middle school trick to show friends.
Yeah, and at times David does whole sentences, but he does the sentences word by word. And I took a step back because I was like, oh, would he do the whole sentence?
Yeah, I think he discusses that because he writes also his personal essay for college.
Right.
It's about his ability to turn words backwards. And so he his idea is to write it in reverse font and word order so that the admissions committee must hold it up to a mirror to read it. And his parents tell him not to do that. It's too much. But, there are different tricks. I gave a reading of this sometime last year, and a woman in the audience came up to me afterward and said she's been doing this her whole life. Mm. And her kids and family members were there, too, and they seconded it. They said she can do this, and she's never met anyone else who can do it. So it does seem to be, I saw a girl on some morning talk show who was very fluent in it as well. It seems to be a strange quirk that a few people pursue, a sort of linguistic quirk that some number of people are sort of fluent in.
That's fascinating to me. But going back to his voice and these words that he uses, it's apparent early on, and I'd love to have you read to us from the book so we can mm-hmm. get that voice in our heads.
Sure. So I'll read from the very beginning. I'll read the first page and a half or so. David, my mother said, we're here. I sat up straight as we passed through the main gate of Harvard Yard in a caravan of unassuming vehicles, rooftops glaring under the noonday sun. Police officers conducted the stammering traffic along the designated route. Freshmen and parents lugged suitcases and boxes heaped with bedding, posing for photos before the red brick dormitories with the shameless glee of tourists. A pair of lanky boys sailed a frisbee over the late summer grass in lazy, slanted parabolas. Amid welcome signs from the administration, student banners interjected, and economic inequality. Silence is violence, and Yale equals safety school. A timpani concerto pounded in my chest as we made landfall on the hallowed ground that had been locked in my sights for years. We'd arrived. I'd arrived. For the tuition we're paying, my father said, carefully reversing into his spot, you'd think it could give us more than 20 minutes to park. My parents climbed out of the car and circled around to the pop trunk. After tugging in vain at my door handle, I tapped on the window. Where'd he go? I could hear my mother ask. In here, I shouted, knocking louder. Sorry, thought you got out, my father said, following my liberation. I checked in under a white tent, teeming with my new classmates, and received my room key and a bulky orientation packet. As we approached Matthews Hall, a girl emerged from the building. Seeing our hands were full, she paused to hold the door. I stepped inside, and my orientation packet slid off the top of the box in my arms. Thanks, I said, when she stooped down to get it. You would have been completely disoriented, said the girl, smiling, her nose streaked with contrails of unabsorbed sunscreen. But she seems nice, my mother said encouragingly as we shuffled upstairs to the fourth floor. The doors were marked with signs listing the occupants in their hometowns, stamped with Harvard's Veritas shield. Beneath these were rosters of previous inhabitants, surname first. My rooms read like an evolutionary timeline of American democracy, beginning with a procession of gilded Boston Brahmins, gradually incorporating a few Catholics, then Goldbergs and Jacksons and Yangs and Guptas, and in the 1970s, Karens and Marys and Patricias. My mother was impressed to discover an NPR correspondent on the list. I'd never heard of her. In 50 years, I thought, I'd humbly recall this moment in career retrospective interviews, insisting that never in my wildest dreams did I imagine my name would someday be the one people noticed. For the time being, though, I knew it didn't quite emblazon itself across the heavens like a verbal comet. David, blandly all-purpose, a three-pack of white cotton undershirts, crew neck medium. Alan, an ulcerous accountant in Westchester circa 1957. Then Faderman, long A sound for first vowel, an entity who was hardly here, or maybe just left. Wait, who are we talking about again? It was as if my parents, upon filling out my birth certificate, couldn't be bothered. Tap is fine, they always told waiters. But now my ID card read, David Alan Faderman, Harvard student.
Thank you. That was Teddy Wayne reading from his new novel, Loner, published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And yes, that opening, with lazy slanted parabolas and timpani concerto. I tuned in immediately to what was going on with David. So you've said here and in other interviews that David is obviously fiction. So can you talk about your development of David as the character?
Yeah, well, I was influenced by these young men who are in the news all the time. There was one yesterday who commits some kind of heinous act, and they're almost always referred to as loners. When they do something horrendous, the media digs into their background and finds out that they were socially isolated for the most part, spend a lot of time by themselves, on their computer usually, and they do something horrible. And this goes from mass shootings to sexual assaults, often to any number of horrible things. And so I think we caricature these young men as monsters because they do monstrous things. But there's more to them than that. So I wanted to inhabit the head of someone who we would cast as this villain and sort of irredeemable, inhuman person, and work sort of from the inside out, develop an idea of this person, and then create some kind of uncomfortable sympathy for the reader who might, while condemning what he does or what he thinks or how he behaves, has some partial identification with him. Because without that, it's not very compelling to me to have just a monster, a Darth Vader, who no one can relate to as a protagonist is too easy. So I wanted to write about someone who was sort of, we have this uneasy alliance with, and real-life figures like Elliot Rodger started figuring into my conception of him. Elliot Rodger is the one who went on that rampage in Isla Vista, and he published a manifesto on the internet that just was rife with sexual frustration and anger. And a lot of what David is operating from is this, what Elliot Rodger suffered from, this idea of toxic masculinity, it's called, which is the way the culture conditions men to be aggressors, to be violent, not to betray sensitivity or vulnerability. And much of their self-worth is wrapped up around their sexual appeal or sexual status. And so David is angry about that. He's also, I think, conditioned by a sort of a privileged white male's syndrome of sensing that his powers that he once took for granted and that were once unchallenged are suddenly perilous in a changing America. And rather than embrace that as progress and recognize he had a tilted playing field toward him for years, he's aggrieved and angry and reacting against that.
And I think I remember reading that an early draft you turned into your agent, and then a few days later was when the Isla Vista shootings happened. Was that?
Mm-hmm.
That's something. And so when you were working on David's character and layering it in this way where there was some sympathy and it was complicated, how did you do that? Did it just evolve as you went through additional drafts, or did you have some other technique for working on him?
The main thing was not making him just one note. And I think doing a balancing act of an obsession that feels increasingly deranged and unstable, but that most readers can identify with up until a certain point. So a good model was Humbert Humbert and Lolita, who, is a pedophile, something just about anyone would condemn. And yet his love for Lolita is powerful and sort of undeniably earnest in its own twisted, distorted way. So I think layering was more about how do I not alienate the reader so much, but alienate the reader to an extent so that we recognize this is disturbing. And it was hard to do, and I think earlier drafts, I was probably afraid of making him too alienating because then it wouldn't have much impact, and then perhaps also at points afraid of making him too relatable because it would look like I was allowing or permitting what he does or condoning it somehow. And so trusting myself and trusting the reader to latch onto him at points and have these little moments of entry where early on, he's, you know, for the first 30, 40 pages, nothing he does is that upsetting. It's a little bit off, but there's many moments I think most readers can connect with, which is he's a scared freshman in a new place and trying to make friends and trying to figure out who he is. And most people can relate to that. It's until later that he gets off the rails more so.
I'm talking to Teddy Wayne about his new novel, Loner. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. After David meets and becomes infatuated with Veronica Morgan Wells, he starts to address her as you. And that has this direct, kind of accusatory and jolting quality that I thought was really well suited to the dynamic. And so I was wondering whether that you popped out in the first draft, or how did you get there?
It didn't. It was not in the first draft. And soon after I finished that first draft, I had a friend read it, and we were talking about it, and I realized this might be a good way to increase the menacing aspect of it. I'm far from the only person to write about obsession who has used the second person address in the same way. So it does, as you point out, add a sense of immediacy and urgency and accusatory tone, and David is accusing Veronica of things. I won't reveal what they are, but he's clearly got an axe to grind throughout this, while at the same time the you is this sort of plea and a desire to be closer to her. So I think it did work much better in second person. As you heard, it's narrated in first person but addressed to her in the second, whereas in the first draft it was just first person and Veronica was she throughout. Mm-hmm.
The tone of the book, which you alluded to. So we start off light, and it's a campus novel, and you read for us the arrival on campus with his family. And then the dread begins. I mean, it's introduced super slowly, and it builds. And in terms of figuring out the pace and the balancing of the sense of dread and measuring it out throughout the novel, were there any challenges with that? I just think from a craft perspective, it's tricky. And so if you can talk about that.
Yeah, so the first draft of this was, I think, 55,000, 58,000 words, something like that. And then I revised it and ballooned to about 80,000, and then revised it more, and it went back to about 60,000, which is where it is now, which is not very interesting for me to say, just word counts, but it got a little bloated at points where I was adding more things. And then I decided this kind of book works best to be incredibly taut and to not have any flab on it. And so for every scene to lead into the next scene, it's not a sort of slow meditative book. It's I want to write it with the propulsion of a thriller, but the language of a more literary novel. So it was hard to, that's not something that comes necessarily naturally to me, and it did require some reworking of it. There's a plot twist that I won't reveal, obviously, that was not there in the first several drafts either. And that, you know, when I implemented that, that took some reworking of the rest of the book so that the twist made sense. But it is hard to do that sort of thing, to have a book where, I mean, it's only 200 pages long or so, where I feel like any scene, if it got taken out, much like a Jenga tower, it would collapse, which is what I was going for. The idea that it's all interconnected, and that every little ingredient is necessary to the final recipe.
So the novel, as we see from the opening, is set at Harvard, and it's, of course, an intriguing setting. And so I'm wondering about the choice to set it there and how that worked its way into the tone.
Well, I did go there as an undergraduate, so it was easier in that regard for obvious reasons. But the bigger reason is that it has the, along with, you know, a few other places, the most name recognition, the most global status of all these colleges. And this book is not just about romantic obsession, but David's obsession with class and power and status otherwise. And so Veronica, I should point out, is from the very, very privileged 1% of Manhattan. Her father's in finance. David is from an upper middle class, nice background in New Jersey. He should be happy with that, but he's not. He wants more greedily. And so Veronica is this represents this world across this chasm that he wants to bridge, much like Harvard is to him this place where he can have access to this sort of life. It could have been Yale or Princeton or Stanford, you know, other colleges that are like this, but to him, it needs to be a place like Harvard or one of those places that assures him of his status or serves as recognition to others of who he is. And it becomes a critique of, you know, the capitalist mentality of always wanting more than you have and wanting the best no matter what, which, as we can see, is certainly making its case felt in politics now.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, changing gears here with the few minutes we have left, I wanted to put in a quick question because you have a monthly column in the New York Times called Future Tense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, so this one's about the anxieties we have about cultural and technological evolutions. And so for this monthly column, how do you manage your ideas? Did you start off with a list and you're going down, or do readers submit ideas that you consider, or how do you organize that?
I do have a list of things that appeal to me. Sometimes my editor will bring ideas to me as well. The column is focusing on cultural and technological shifts. So a recent one was on whether viewing violent videos via social media is somehow more traumatizing than through old media like TV or you know, I guess print, even though you wouldn't see videos in print. And so it's a combination of things that I observe myself, things I hear about, scientific studies that I run across that are compelling to me. And, you know, a lot of this is just the way we live now. So noticing how texting changes relationships, or how email is no longer used for real letters the way it once was. And you know, without necessarily issuing moral judgments, although sometimes I probably do, to analyze and investigate how is the tech or the cultural shifts otherwise, the non-technological ones, how are they altering the way we relate to one another?
Well, that sounds like a whole other show topic we could easily do, but as we draw down on our time here, do you have any writing advice for the writers out there aspiring to write novels?
Yeah, I think the one that Hemingway had, which is finish, when you finish writing for the day, don't finish everything you want to write. Leave either like halfway through a sentence or, you know, a few sentences to go, but leave something in the tank so that you have something can pick up where you left off the next day. Because the hardest thing seems to be, for me and for others, simply starting and beginning to write. And once you develop a head of steam, it's much easier. So if you know what you're going to write the next day, whether it's an outline of the next scene that's coming or actually a sentence, it's much easier to resume work than starting from scratch.
And using that advice, do you have I'm just curious if you have a time goal or a word count goal, or how you also manage that part of the goal system?
Yeah, for fiction, I try to aim for at least 500 words per session. And I often go above that, but 500 is the minimum I shoot for. And I rarely get above 1,500 would be a very productive day. And I've found for myself I can write for 3 to 4 hours at a time, fiction, and I sort of burn out after that. Nonfiction, I can do much longer. So different strokes for different folks, obviously, but for me that works, and I do recommend, I think, shorter bursts like that rather than people who spend 10 hours writing all day. It seems to me that it would be hard to imagine that at hour 9 you're doing as well as you were at hour 1 or 2. And I think you might just be dawdling, and that time could be better served reading or doing other things with your life that might open up more ideas for your fiction than actually just continuing to write.
Well, Teddy, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
That was author Teddy Wayne. His novel is Loner, published by Simon & Schuster. During the second part of the show, author Sean Wong will be here, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. The show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please consider subscribing. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at WOWKUCIFM. I'm your host for the hour, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with writer Teddy Wayne, and next up is author Sean Wong. Sean's first novel, Home Base, won both the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Award and the 15th Annual Governor's Writer's Day Award of Washington. He's also the co-editor and editor of 6 Asian American and American multicultural literary anthologies, including the pioneering anthology IE, an anthology of Asian American writers, and The Big IE, an anthology of Chinese America and Japanese America in literature. And Sean is one of the founding teachers of the Red Badge Project, which we'll talk about. He's currently professor of English and comparative literature at University of Washington. His second novel, American Knees, published by Simon & Schuster and reissued by the University of Washington Press, was adapted into a film titled American Knees with the ending ESE, directed by Eric Baylor. And we'll start by talking about his most recent novel, American Knees, and get to more. Hi there, Sean.
Hi, Nicole. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm so pleased you're here to join us. And before we even get to your novel, American Knees, I want to talk about your history, because you had an interesting entry into literature at UC Berkeley. So there you were, a student passionate about literature in the late 1960s and looking for more Asian American writers. Can you talk about that experience?
I think at the age of 19, I was an English major at Berkeley, and at the age of 19, I decided I wanted to be a novelist or a writer, you know. I think I had been writing really bad poetry for a year, so I thought I was qualified. And I also remember at that exact moment realizing that I was the only Asian American writer I knew in the world, and that no college professor or high school teacher of English had ever not only never assigned a book by an Asian American author, but never even mentioned the name of one. And so there I was with this unusual position of me being the only Asian American writer I knew, and I was unpublished. So I thought to myself, in the 150 years of Asians being in America, somebody must have written something and published. And so I started looking for them.
And you taught a class as a graduate student at San Francisco State University. And as far as we know, I think, was that the first Asian American?
It was the second.
Oh, okay.
There was one of my friends and later co-editor of IE, Jeffrey Chan, actually taught the very first one. But I taught the second one in the country. And it was based on finding these writers who had been ignored or neglected, and their works had gone out of print for the most part. And so through our, I had the unusual position of not only being a writer who was working on my own creative work, but I also had to assume the responsibility of educating the audience to Asian American literary history so that the reading of my own work could be informed by my own literary history. So that's an odd position to be in. And then when my book came out, my first novel, Home Base, it was the only Chinese-American novel in print in America when it came out in 1979.
Wow.
So we didn't advance very far.
Well, in 2016, have we made some progress, both literarily and societally?
Oh, yes. I think since the mid-80s and on, there have been not only a great number of Asian American writers who've been published and gained a lot of fame, but also, you know, multicultural literature in general became much more broader. At the same time, I was looking for Asian American writing when I was an undergraduate. Things like African-American writing, which was well-known, but it was often very limited to writing about being poor, being in jail, being in the ghetto, and, you know, and the representation of African-Americans in literature very rarely went beyond those roles in the late 60s.
In your book, Americanese, the protagonist, Raymond, is struggling with this issue of multiculturalism and identity in, he lives in the Bay Area in California. And so can you introduce that book to us?
Well, he's, when I was working on the book, I tend to, because I teach Asian American literature, most of the things I published are informed by my knowledge of Asian American literature. So in a sense, I was always trying to kind of fill a gap in the literature. For example, much of Asian American writing at the time that I started working on my second novel was essentially grandma arriving in America stories. You know, it's always about the first generation immigrant. There's nothing wrong with that story, but it was fairly limiting. And even my students that I was teaching wanted something else. And so, and they wanted to, in some ways, see themselves in the work, and they were sort of clamoring for, let's move up a few generations, you know, let's see something contemporary. And then they started throwing out various kinds of topics, you know, mixed race identity. We weren't seeing that in the literature. We were only seeing one ethnic group in the literature, you know, books set in Chinatown or Japantown. And there was nothing funny. Every book was tragic, you know, sort of the tragic immigrant story. So I kind of threw all those things in the mixing bowl and decided to write a romantic comedy that was about mixed race and Pan-Asian identity and of course, a very contemporary story.
And it also goes into the sexuality of both Asian men and women and the stereotypes and the actual experience and the views of each other.
Right. I also wanted to show, sort of poke fun at the media for limiting our portrayal in film and television. And, you know, we're always, as for men, you know, we're always the houseboy or we're the Bruce Lee martial artist. And for women, you know, it was sort of demure, docile servant or dragon lady, you know, the opposite. So there were only these kinds of extremes. And we never seemed to actually talk to each other, you know, from one Asian to another. And so I decided to make my romantic comedy about stereotypes, not only of Asians in the media, but also stereotypes that one Asian group might have over another Asian group. The kinds of things that never get discussed. And so, and of course, in writing a romantic comedy, I also had to put romance in it and sex, and that was something else you never saw us having relationships, you know, real serious relationships in the media. I think the novelist Gish Jin, after reading my book, said it best when she said, finally, racial issues made racy.
In terms of the canon, or I don't know what to call it, but works of immigrant literature and immigrant novels, I'm curious if you've read Jade Chang's new book, The Wangs Versus the World.
No, I haven't read that one yet.
Oh, okay. Because, yeah, it's hardly a Grandma Comes to America story.
No, there's a lot of books now that have reached out, obviously, beyond that immigrant arrival story, like Gish Jin, who I just talked about, and other writers like Chang Rai Lee, et cetera.
I was interested to hear you talk about consciously pushing against the stereotypes, especially with regard to the female characters in your book, because you did such a job that, I mean, I paid a lot of attention to the way that you wrote those women, because I thought it was both sensitive to their complexity and also they felt real. Can you talk about writing female characters? Was that...
Thank you for that compliment. It's difficult. You know, I mean, a writer in many ways has to be a method actor. You know, you have to inhabit those characters. And people always ask me, you know, if I'm the male character, Raymond Ding, and I say, no, I'm all the characters. You know, parts of me are in all the characters. And I think in writing about female characters, you know, you have to be them as a writer. And surprisingly, all it takes is, you know, I mean, I was raised by a woman, my mother, and I know in my particular past, my father died when I was 7, and so I spent a lot of time alone with my mother. And I think I sort of learned very early on to watch her and to listen to her and to grow up as a young man shaped only by a woman, you know. And so one of the things I know when I was working on this particular book, American Niece, is that I did the same thing. I watched and I listened, but I listened very closely to how women talked about relationships and race and things like that. You know, it's sort of like what a method actor does when they're, you know, they're going to play a cop and they do a ride along with police and they sit in the back seat and they listen to how police talk. You might say, I was doing a ride along, you know, with women, and I sat in the back seat and I listened. And, you know, in this case, it might have been in a kitchen or in a living room or just to my female students, you know, when they come to my office and start talking. You know, it's really just about language and dialogue and, you know, having conversation.
I'm talking to Sean Wong, whose most recent novel is American Knees. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Sean, I'd love to have you read to us from the book.
Okay. This is the opening of American Knees, and American Knees is K-N-E-E-S. And this explains a little bit of what the title means. You won't even be Chinese after your wife's attorney gets through with you, Raymond, Sylvia Beacon Yamaki said, flipping the pages of Darlene's proposed divorce settlement. Raymond wondered if someone could be a lapsed Chinese in the same way people became lapsed Catholics. If Darlene took away her family from him, and he ceased having the opportunity to be the dutiful Chinese son, would that make him a lapsed Chinese? What good was a good Chinese son without a Chinese family in which to practice his legendary Chinese filial duty? What would Raymond do, go around telling people, "Hi, my name is Raymond Ding. I used to be Chinese, but my wife got custody of my ethnicity." Raymond wondered if this was cultural diversity at its worst. Perhaps not being Chinese was an option in America. Certainly it was easy enough to change your mind and decide to be some other Asian ethnicity, such as Japanese, Korean, Vietnamese, Thai, Cambodian, Malaysian, or even a different kind of Chinese, such as Taiwanese? What non-Asian would know? Or Raymond could even be Chinese from Little Rock, Arkansas, where folks would refer to him as, say, Ray, Ray Bob Dang, and his accent would mark him unmistakably as American. He had once met a Korean immigrant who had learned English in North Carolina. Her talk, for the most part, perfect English, some confusion with R's and L's, an occasional H thrown in behind an A, and a wandering accent on polysyllabic words that made her sound like Nancy Kwan in the world of Susie Wong with Richard Petty as her English teacher. But when she drawled, people knew she was an American. When Raymond spoke with no accent, they just noticed that he spoke pretty good English. In the schoolyard, kids used to taunt him. "What are you? Chinese, Japanese, or Americanese?" they'd chant, slanting the corners of their eyes up and down, displaying a buck-tooth smile and pointing at their knees. When Raymond, not liking any of the choices, didn't answer, they'd say, "Then you must be dirty knees."
Thank you. That was Sean Wong reading from his most recent book, American Knees, published by University of Washington Press. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And for the screenplay, which I understand you co-wrote with the director, Eric Baylor.
Eric Beiler. I wrote the first two drafts, and then he wrote the final version.
Okay. And at what point, because you just tweaked the title for the movie.
Yes.
Can you talk about that decision?
The executive producer wanted the title changed because we never actually explained what American Knees, the original title, means in the movie. Mm-hmm. So they changed it to American Ease, like Chinese, Japanese. Mm. And, you know, the executive producer puts up all the money to make the movie, so we protested for like a minute.
So if you wrote the whole first two drafts, did you just jump right in then to screenwriting? Because it's a different discipline.
It is a different discipline, and I didn't really like it at first because it seemed so limiting. But I actually teach screenwriting now here at the University of Washington. It's a very clean form of writing because it's so limiting. You can only write what you can see and what you can hear, and that's it. So for a novelist who likes to be in control of everything, it's a little bit of an adjustment. I think I've become a much better screenwriter when I'm not working on my own story. And I have a little more objectivity.
Because there is a good amount of dialogue, but I just imagine it would be tricky, to do your own work.
Yeah, well, you have to condense it. You can only, obviously a film can only do a small portion of the novel. And so it gets very condensed. But the gratifying thing to me in looking at the movie is that the director, Eric Beiler, used all of my characters and didn't change any of them. And so you actually, as a writer, get to see your characters come alive in front of you visually, which is a very surreal experience because they only existed in my head as a fiction. And suddenly there they are standing in front of you on the set, being these fictional people that you created.
I'm going to shift gears here because of the clock, and I want to hear about your involvement with the Red Badge Project.
Yeah.
So for those who aren't familiar, can you tell us what it is and start with that?
The Red Badge Project started 5 years ago, or almost 5 years ago now, as a concept by the actor Tom Skerritt and a retired Army captain, Evan Bailey. They were next-door neighbors, or they still are next-door neighbors. And Tom Skerritt lives in Seattle, by the way. They had read a statistic, you know, that more soldiers and veterans were committing suicide than were being killed in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan every month. And one of the reasons that was cited was the difficulty of telling their story of what they're involved in or what happened to them, particularly the injured soldiers. And so Tom called me and some other storytellers, screenwriters, novelists, Brian McDonald and Warren Etheridge, he said to us, you know, we know how to teach storytelling, so let's see if we can teach these soldiers how to tell their story and stop the suicides, at least here in Washington State. And the lucky thing of having a movie star being your point person is that people will talk to him and listen to him. And so Tom called a general in Washington, D.C. and said, you know, we'd like to go to Joint Base Lewis McChord here in Tacoma, Washington, and start a storytelling class. And the general said, that's a good idea, made a call. And we found ourselves on base teaching in the Warrior Transition Battalion, which is the soldiers who are transitioning out of the Army because of their injuries, both physical, emotional, and mental. And so we became part of their therapy program. There's a unit called adaptive therapy, in which soldiers learn either recreational therapies, you know, like horseback riding or glass blowing or other things, and our storytelling workshop became part of their therapy. And through the last 5 years, we've expanded it now to vet centers. We still have the same teachers. We've expanded also. We added two new teachers, Sonia Leah, and Suzanne Morrison, and they've started a women's vet writing group to great success. Between the five teachers and Tom, who also teaches with us, we are trying to cover the state of Washington and bring our storytelling workshops to them. And what we've found over the years, one, is that they're extremely effective. And number two, the most surprising thing is in these workshops, these classes that we teach, the interesting thing is that we never planned on is that students and the soldiers, at the end of class, we think, well, you know, we sort of graduate them, we give them a certificate, and we expect, like any teacher, to have a new class, but we found is they don't go away. Mm. They just sign up again and continue. We've had some soldiers and vets take the class 5, 6, 7 times. And we've seen significant changes, not only mentally and emotionally, but also physically. In some cases, soldiers who've had extreme traumatic brain injury, something happens, their brain rewires itself when they're involved in a creative, artistic endeavor like storytelling.
And in terms of your approach to teaching them storytelling, I read somewhere that you had to think on the fly because sometimes your prompts that you would use in a university classroom weren't working with these students.
You know, I've been teaching now for 44 years, and I have thousands of writing prompts in my head, but I found right away none of those writing prompts worked with the soldiers, none of them. And so I had to quickly change, and I realized why right away was, number one, I never had a class in which every single student shared pretty much the same experience. And they also, I had a class that worked extremely well collaboratively. They were used to working in teams. They were used to supporting each other. And I found that to be something that we could use, you know, in the class. You know, a lot of, and we never write about combat or, that's the last thing they want to write about. They want to write about, and they don't want to write about what happened to them, you know, why they were injured, or they might talk about it, but they don't want to write about it. And we found that the thing that they really want to write about is family. They want to write about growing up. They're trying to come to terms with, many of them have extremely difficult upbringing as children, as young adults. And many of them went into the Army, you know, as teenagers, as 18-year-olds, even 17-year-olds. And they, you know, they were still growing and still learning. So it was interesting having to readjust my writing assignments to that kind of classroom dynamic.
Well, Sean, we're almost out of time, but before I let you go, do you have any writing advice for the writers listening now?
Probably fairly boring advice, which is write every day. If there are soldiers and vets out there who want to see what the Red Batch Project is doing in terms of storytelling, they can go to our website, which is theredbadgeproject.org. And one of the things I always say to the soldiers that I teach is that you might not be able to control what happened to you in life, but as a writer, you can control the message of what happened to you. And I think that goes along not only for the veterans, but also for all student writers.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Nicole.
That was Sean Wong, author of American Knees, published by University of Washington Press. That's all the time we have for today. Until next time, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.